The following is a recording of a discussion group at Ordinary Mind Zendo. The texts we take up for study in these groups range from koan collections to poetry to psychoanalytic papers. If you enjoy listening, please consider donating. Ordinary Mind Zendo is a nonprofit organization that depends on the generosity of people like you. Good afternoon. Say something, or shall I just mention?
Well, I've sort of introduced you to them in advance, so if you have something you'd like to begin with, do that, then we'll have some questions for you afterwards.
Okay. So there are a lot of narratives about our relationship to Kaido Fukushima Roshi. He was the teacher of Shibayama Zenkei, and really a remarkable person who had been a priest since he was about 14. He dedicated himself to Buddhism, I guess during World War II, when he lost, I think, his grandmother and his sister. So he wanted, as many Japanese do, to assure them a place in heaven with his practice. And it's an interesting idea. But very Japanese. So some of the stories are about his training. Some of the stories about practice that he offered, particularly for Westerners, because he came. Are any of you familiar with his visits here? He visited mostly universities, and he came every year and had a long list in one of my books of facts he sent me of all the universities he was visiting. And I always wondered, why do you go to universities and not Zen centers? Then, as I started doing koan practice with him in Japan, and I saw there were like 3,500 koans, I said, oh, you need young people. if you want to have some Western successors. So this is why I think he went there, partly why. I visited Japan the first time in the early 80s with a group of women, and we did a practice period at Suzuki Roshi's home temple in Yaizu with his son Hoitsu Roshi and Blanche Hartman. It was kind of a miraculous occurrence, and it gave me a taste for practice in Japan. And then I went back a couple more times, and then I realized, oh, you're looking for a teacher here. So I found Fukushima Roshi through, as it happens, three events. One was that I was sitting in a public bath, and the woman next to me who spoke English said, oh, what are you here for? And I told her, and she said, oh, well, we have this great resource in Kyoto. And so it's in Kyoto, Fukushima Roshi. And I said, well, he's Rinzai and I'm Soto. So that was the first time. And the second time, I saw his name in a book of Zen temples for Westerners. And so I noted, and then the third time I was trying to reach out to Uchiyama Roshi, and it was really wonderful. I was just leaving my apartment to get on the plane, and the phone rang, and I kind of got chills, and it was Shohaku Okamura, who I had reached out to, and said, maybe I could meet Uchiyama. And he said, well, you need to talk to Tom Wright about where Uchiyama Roshi is physically right now. So when I got to Kyoto, I reached out to Tom Wright, and he said, Uchiyama Roshi is too old to take any more students. It was good. I didn't want to be responsible for putting more stress on him. I'm not an easy keeper, so I might argue a bit. So when he said Uchiyama Roshi was too old, he said, but Fukushima Roshi still takes Western students. And so I said, well, there must be a reason. This is the third time I've heard his name. There must be a reason for this. And I didn't know anything about him. Fukushima Roshi was known to the Japanese as Go Roshi, one of the top teachers in Japan. I don't know anything about this, but I learned a little by the experiences I had when I spoke to Japanese people about the fact we were practicing with him. But for example, if the Prime Minister needed to consult, of Japan needed to consult a Zen master, this is the one. But he had spent a year in California at Claremont College, directed by Shibayama Roshi, that he needed to take over the Western visits. And so he had a fondness for Americans. And he went to many colleges, and I didn't know this at the time. And he told all the students that he met, please come practice at my temple. It's the shortcut to enlightenment. So anyway, not knowing any of this, I called up and I asked for him. I don't even remember what title I used. And they said, well, who is this? I said, well, this is Grace. So they assumed it was one of the students he had invited to the temple. And I didn't know, so I get on the phone. They put him on the phone, and he says, I tell him that I'm looking for a place to practice in Kyoto. And because at that particular time, I wanted to practice. My husband was more interested in sushi and sake. And I figured Kyoto was a great place for him to do that and for me to do my practice. And this is the way we could work it out at that particular time. Later, when he saw that something was actually happening based on this koan practice, then he wanted to practice. And also, we had kind of whittled down the schedule that was 3 in the morning to 11 at night. We had whittled it down to something that he said, I think I can live through that. Anyway, so when I called, I told him I wanted a place to practice at Kyoto, and he said, okay, well, do you want to meet tonight? Or something like this. I said, well, that sounds good. But I'm not sure if I can find you, because I know Tofukuji is a very big temple, and it's hard. And he said, I'll send a car for you. And we made arrangements where we were staying. So Peter, my husband, looks out the window. He says, oh my God, what have you gotten me into? Our ride is here. You know, there's a Japanese limo with a monk coming out and geta and everything else. He said, another adventure you've gotten me into. So anyway, we went to the temple, and our experience afterwards, and I think, you know, I just read Zen Odyssey, which is coming out about Sokeon, and he had this quality too, of a kind of energetic presence that you feel like when you meet one of these teachers, what just happened? Something happened to me, and I don't even know what it was. So Fukushima Roshi had that, so afterwards Peter and I were kind of reeling, feeling like, you know, we'd been hit in the hara with something. The wind was knocked out. It was probably a little ego stuffing was knocked out. And I said, it seems like Joshi's alive and well, and he's speaking English in Kyoto and taking Western students, so I need to do this. And it was pretty terrifying, and they don't make it unterrifying. When we called to say, well, you know, Grace is coming to do this session. I was doing a practice period at Rinso Inn again that year. It must have been 85. And, whenever it was. Anyway, they said, we asked, you know, what about the last day? You know, does it end early on the last day? They said, oh, no. This is 3 to 11, you know, for 7 days. And, you know, she has to understand this is, you know, this is the real thing. Mm-hmm. So all this was translated back for me. And then I got scared. But I had already made my commitment. So there I was on the train from Shizuoka, which is closer to Tokyo, to Kyoto, crying the whole way. People are looking at me, what is up with this? You know, the Japanese are looking away. And it was as terrible as I thought. In fact, I think I cried all the way through the whole session. What made it so terrible? Not knowing what was going on around you, having people yell at you in Japanese, the terrible the size almost of a baseball bat, the stick that the monks were getting hit with, that they got hit so hard, the tatami vibrated. I don't want to idealize it at all. It was horrific, but I somehow knew it was my karma. Whatever I had done, this is where I needed to be. So, over the course of practicing with him, I did do koan study with him, maybe over the course of a dozen years, and as we got to about the 10-year point, he developed a really pervasive Parkinson's disease. And so he didn't teach, but he did see us for Doksan when we went to Kyoto, and it was a massive effort, as his whole life had been, for him even to be dressed and wheeled out in a wheelchair into the Doksan room and so on. It was very moving. So during the time before he was too sick, he told me that when I asked him, what do I do with this now that I've been studying these koan with you, I'm not going to finish. And he said, just teach the ones you've learned, you know, up to the ones you've passed. Because I thought, and I suggested to him, maybe I should do what the Koreans do, which is just to teach one koan. And for a lifetime, people work on one koan. He said, no, I want you to follow my curriculum up to the point that you passed it. So that's what I did. And I continued some koan study here in the West after he passed, because he told me that there was no, that he didn't want me to study with anyone else, just to do the koan with him. So after he died, then I did. So I wanted to say, as a psychologist, what attracted me directly to Fukushima Roshi, and that's in the first chapter, stop and look under your own feet. So it's really not so much about the feet, so much as it's your own. Look at your own shit. Look at your own self. Look at your own mind. In fact, I twice brought over a group of students to meet with him, and one asked, cleverly and most importantly asked, what is the most important thing? And he said, watching your mind. Which was like, oh, yes, that's it. It's not about doing the bows perfectly or not dropping your chopsticks in Oriyoki. It's about being able to watch your mind in action. So this is the chapter that I put first. Look at your own feet. Examine yourself and what you are doing. And these chapters came from over 200 tapes that he'd done at the universities. And we listened for themes. My husband and I listened for themes and then transcribed it and then tried to organize them. So the first section is, what is Zen? Stop and look under your own feet. Look at your own feet. Examine yourself and what you are doing. So in Zen, we say, look under your own feet. I actually hadn't heard that expression before. There were a lot of expressions that he taught that hadn't yet come to us as Westerners. These are the words of Master Sanko Kokushi from the 13th century. He inscribed the message near the bottom of a large pole at the entrance of the kitchen at his temple. Because he wrote the message near the bottom of the pole, visitors read it as a request that they arrange their shoes neatly. And in fact, arranging the shoes neatly, I know my own American teacher and my Zen teachers have said, in Japan have said, you can see the state of mind by the way the shoes are arranged. And sort of, where are people practicing? But that's not what they meant. Nowadays, people don't arrange their shoes neatly because they are not taught to do so within the family culture and home. So, look under your own feet is encouragement to straighten your shoes. But the actual source of the expression was a mondo, a public dialogue between Sanko Kokushi and a disciple. The disciple asked him, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming to China from India? look under your own feet, Sanko Kokushi replied. And so then he goes on to tell the story, which I assume most of you know, about Bodhidharma taking Zen from India to China, or bringing Buddhism over and it becoming Zen there. What the disciples question, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming to China from India, is the meaning of the question is, what is Zen? Is it useful? How do we take on this practice? And Sanko Kokushi answered the monk's question with, look under your own feet. So where would it be except in yourself? And when people ask me, you know, why did Bodhidharma come to the West, some kind of ceremony, I say it came from me. You know, and if he can help a poor schlepper like me, then that's pretty big. So sometimes he goes on to talk about the use of the phrase in Japan. Sometimes newspapers or others who don't really know Zen reverse the phrase as shoko kyaka rather than kyaka shoko, but literally the Japanese would be the foot upon which the light shines. This foot comes first, not someone else's foot. And I think this, for me, I don't know what your habits of mind are, I'm like a correction machine. I always see where some improvement can happen with someone else. This is not our way. Every time I catch myself doing that, it's like, what's going on with you right now? And then he tells these charming stories through the book. Once a month, I travel to Osaka by train to give a Zen lecture. If I arrive early, I get off the train at the shopping level and watch the people of Osaka as they shop. They are a representative sample of modern-day Japanese people rushing around. Egotism sprouts like horns, and shoppers resemble stampeding buffaloes. This is not only the case in Osaka. It's the same in Nagoya, Kyoto, and especially Tokyo. The scramble and rush is characteristic of every big city in Japan, and people probably scramble the fastest in Tokyo. I was standing by a pole in the station watching people and thinking about how they were rushing around. A high school student ran into me and said, "Watch where you're going, you shit monk. Kuso bones." I think it's more like shithead.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we tried to get that in the book, but they made us use shit monk. I tried to get shithead monk because I thought that was really what was intended. "Watch where you're going, you shit monk." I stopped him and asked, "What did you say?" The student lowered his head and replied, "I'm sorry I called you a shit monk." I told him I didn't mind him calling me a shit monk. If I am a shit monk, then you're a shit student. Everybody has shit. I don't mind that part. It's what you said before that. You said, "Watch where you're going." I was standing still, and you bumped into me. It's you who needs to watch where you're going. If I had stopped a businessman who'd bumped into me and asked him the same question, he would have probably called me a shit monk again. Meeting the student was an unusual turn of events. He was young and innocent, and he apologized. It takes courage to stop, but it doesn't mean you stay stopped. It's just a matter of stopping for a little while to take a good look at your feet and what's going on around you. In the middle of our struggle for existence, we need the courage to stop, even if it's just for a little while. By mustering the courage to stop, you may find a meaningful next step or even a new direction. Look at your own feet, examine yourself and what you are doing. So that was his teaching, and as always, he was quite charming. There's another wonderful, charming colloquial chapter in here called Joshu, you SOB. And the reason for that chapter was that he made a pilgrimage to China to go to Joshi's temple. Fukushima Roshi only lectured from the record of Joshi. He wanted to cover all of his expressions in his lifetime. I don't know whether he did. So they made a pilgrimage, maybe, 15 to 20 Rinzai monks to Joshi's temple. And one of them was standing there by the pillar, which was a memorial to Joshi, crying and carrying on Joshi USOB or whatever the equivalent is in Japan. And Fukushima goes on to explain. Everybody understood. Anybody who's ever done the Mukoan understood that this was Joshi who did this to you.
Yeah.
This is Joshi who created this very narrow gate, gateless gate, for people to work their way through. So that he talks about that in here too. How are we doing for time?
Well, I'd like to sort of ask you some questions and then open it up and
okay.
We'll see how we do that. I think first of all, people, I'm interested in your previous Soto experience and how that differed. When you talk about watch your mind moment to moment, it certainly sounds like Shikantaza.
It does, doesn't it?
Right? So, and when I think of Rinzai practice and doing Mu, it's a concentration practice which is exactly the opposite of watching your mind moment to moment. I mean, there's a way in which you're attempting to focus in a different way.
Yes.
Yes. So what, after all those years of Soto, what did you feel was missing? What did you want to do?
I couldn't have put it into words then. But I felt like I had reached kind of some kind of wall with my relationship with my teacher, who, when I was writing my book on Zen women, told me it was just an ego trip and I should cease and desist. Yes. And so it wasn't the most harmonious relationship. In fact, I can say, as I have said in other publications at Berkeley Zen Center, Sojin and I fought the most for any student and teacher that ever stayed together. But I felt in some way that I had reached a place that I was stuck. So I wasn't sure what I was looking for. But there's the next mondo I was going to talk about in the book is Joshi's Throw It Away. And so I think it has something to do with that mondo, actually, because one of Joshi's Dharma heirs, or who was about to become his Dharma heir, came to him and said, "What do you say to the one who has let go of everything, who has thrown everything away?" And Joshi said, "Throw it away." And he said, "How can you say throw it away? I just told you I'd thrown everything away." And Joshi said, "Very well then, keep on carrying it." And at which point the monk could see his own mind, and Fukushima has a commentary on that mondo in the book. But I do see Soto Zen is keep on carrying it, as you keep examining what arises over and over again. And the koan practice is throw it away. There's nothing there. And in fact, the way I practiced, because I hadn't really been given any instruction, I had to find my way in this, whatever it was, 700-year-old temple, which had this slate tiles, not like the ones we see here. I mean, real slate. They'd been hand-carved, and they're not grouted. There's spaces between them. And so in Rinzai, we would face in looking at the slate floor. And what I would do was pour myself down the cracks in the slate. And so that essentially was a throw it away practice. So there are those aspects of practice that we can develop. And when my students ask me, well, how do I know which to use? It's like, well, throw it away is the most efficient. If you could throw something away, throw it away. But if you can't, keep on caring.
When you say throw it away, is that akin to self-emptying? Is that what you
mean? It's let it go. Let it go. You don't ever find your mind obsessing over something that's unnecessary, right? It's in that state that you say, let it go. I say to myself all the time, let it go. And if I can, I do. And if I can't, I leave it there with lots of space to be present with it, see what it is it's teaching me. Is that Soto to you?
Soto to me is about leaving everything as you find it. Yes, and that the core insight for me in Soto is the mind is not defiled by its contents, therefore nothing needs to be thrown away.
Yeah, well, maybe that works for you when you're suffering. Mm-hmm. I need more action when I'm suffering, which is, okay, this is your mind is biting this. Mm-hmm. What happens when you open your jaws? And then leave it as it is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So each person needs to find the way that they work. You work your way, as Sojin said when he was in his mountain seat ceremony, somebody says, what's your wisdom about practice? He said, you turn me and I'll turn you. We all need to find the way to turn. And it's very, to me, it's totally idiosyncratic to what kind of mind you're working with. And you know it better than anyone else. But you need to share it with your teacher to look for how do you apply? How do you apply these teachings?
See, I always feel it's not even so much throwing it away as finally allowing it to be taken away. Because
it's not going to continue anyway.
Yeah, and when you're throwing, you're still feeling like you have the control and the agency, you know. And
yeah, realizing
my life doesn't feel like that.
Mine does. My mind does. So yeah, that works for you. The sense of things come and go anyway, and how do I just let it be, is more for your mind.
So, I have another question. One thing that intrigued me about your story was the relationship between your Soto teacher hitting this wall, potentially having to do with you being a woman, and him possibly not having taught many women, and then being with the Japanese teacher who you had a better relationship with. I'm wondering, to what degree it was Rinzai versus a more open relationship with the teacher.
I think it taught me that having the two teachers taught me something about having a teacher. The reason things were so difficult with my Western teacher, Sojin Mel Weitzman Roshi, was because I believe your primary teacher is responsible for your character. And he was constantly working on my character. And that's very painful, if you know what I mean. I don't know if your teacher does that, but there are ways that we're selfish, there are ways we're egotistical, and it's your root teacher, to me, the root teacher really is responsible for that before they turn you loose. And my relationship with Fukushima Roshi was warm and more formal. He was teaching me to do koan practice and welcoming me to his temple. Occasionally I got a little whack, but not so much. And it was Sojin's responsibility to say, get over yourself. So that's why I feel it was difficult, and why going into another practice helped me continue working with depth without this. And then I understood this a little more.
Mm-hmm. That's such a common story of two teachers.
Yes, yes, yes. And the same with Fukushima Roshi, and that's what helped me realize it, because he wrote about his root teacher, who was very strict with him, you know, in every single way when he was just a boy. And then the elegant relationship he had with Shibayama Zenke, who was a scholar and a brilliant teacher, and very different. So that helped me understand, oh, this is what's going on.
One of my reactions to reading the training section is that this kind of equation with strictness and intensity being the one and only pathway to realization and depth is the kind of story we've sort of spent a generation trying to get over.
Yeah, getting over that, sure.
And that's the sort of thing made Joko crazy. You know, the idea that real Zen is the one where you do the 7-day sesshin with no sleep until you have the big realization, and that's it.
Right.
She would have said, I want any of my students to read that book.
I don't think he said it's the only way. I think he said it's the Rinzai way.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the Rinzai way,
mm-hmm.
and it isn't a way that I would use with my students
mm-hmm.
either.
Mm-hmm.
But I did see something very interesting when I was in Japan. First of all, the young men, and they were young. Mm-hmm. There was the young men and there was me. The old lady in the Zendo.
Mm-hmm.
So the young man that I would see, and over the course of the years I was there, who came in, the Japanese monks, changed. I saw the effect. Now maybe maturity would have had the same effect, but I saw the effect the practice had on them.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the effect that this strict practice had on them. And that's the practice they wanted to do. Many of them were sons of temple priests who were practicing in the Tofukuji lineage. And I feel that there were times when I really had to talk myself down from standing up in the Zendo and going on a rant about this kind of beating is unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized, oh, I see. These young men are here. It's like football training to them.
They're there for boot camp.
Yeah.
And I guess that is the question. How do we get out of boot camp model and preserve something of the realization? But the dilemma is that the language of his stories makes these two things seem inextricable.
It does, and Peter and I struggled with that because we would have liked to edit that out.
Mm.
But we didn't, because his words.
That's really how he thinks about that.
That's correct.
And there's a way in which it maintains this model of the ego or the self is something to be overcome. That there's a kind of, we have to conquer something or break something or smash through something
mm-hmm.
in order to see the truth, that our ordinary mind is the problem, not the way. See, he comes around at the end after your realization, now it's all the way. But before, the assumption of the training is you're the problem.
Yes, he was describing this training to college students,
mm-hmm.
the glamour, the cowboy, you know, the samurai. And this is an aspect that I didn't adopt in my training methods.
Mm-hmm.
But that I recognized the benefit of while I was there. For example, there was a way that the difficulty of the training brought a different kind of focus into my body, mind, and how I worked. For example, and I had this discussion with him, when I talked to him about the Soto, and not Joko's practice, mm-hmm. but the Soto practice of how we get our okesa just right, and we're always fussing with our robes, he said, oh, you Soto,
yeah.
Monks in your robes. And I said, you Rinzai monks in your slippers. So their slippers had to be put down just so.
Yeah, that's right.
And so in my first sesshin, after 7 days of struggling with these flip-flops, and then you have to, at various times, you have to know when to take them off, you have to know where to put them, and they have to be perfect. I put them down on the last day, and they were. And I knew something had shifted in my body. So even though I wouldn't recommend, and anybody asked me about the place, I said, I won't recommend it as a practice place to you. Mm-hmm. I felt like I got some advantage. And in that same first session, I told my husband, who was practicing Soto Zen at Rinso Inn, we were at a practice period, and I left early to do the session at Tofugiji. I said, okay, if I call you and tell you that I twisted my ankle, you know you're going to find me in a luxury hotel in Kyoto that I washed out. But that's the code. I twisted my ankle. Tell everybody I twisted my ankle and you have to come to Kyoto to rescue me. Got it? Yeah. Okay.
That's your safe word.
That's my safe word.
Yeah,
so anyway, he came to Kyoto. I made it, crying my way through, like down a river through the whole session. And he came to meet me, and he said, let's go for a walk together. You know, we were with a group of people, 20 people or something. He said, let's go for a walk together. I said, great. We walked down the canal in Kyoto. And he reached out to take my hand, and I took his hand, and he screamed. He said, you're going to break my hand. That's the kind of force that comes with Rinzai training. It may or may not be useful. But there is a kind of integration that happens with body-mind. And there was another woman I practiced with who had been a student of Suzuki Roshi's, and she practiced at Tofugiji. And she said, Soto is slow and precise, you know, when we do our yoki. Rinzai is fast and so it has a different flavor. Might not be useful to a particular person. I certainly wouldn't have recommended and don't recommend practicing in Rinzai Temple in Japan. However, for me, it was useful. Mm-hmm. It helped me get through something. It brought up some kind of energy. And as I said, when I met him, you could feel that energy. It's the same energy that Ruth Fuller Sasaki, you'll see her book, it's coming out, Zen Odyssey, describes that people experience around Sokeon. There's something that happens with that. It might not be worth it, you know, in the long run, but it's nice that the options are there for people who want to try that. Some people really swear by the koan practice, which requires that kind of breakthrough.
So you would say that koan practice is at least inextricable from
the Rinzai? Yes, yes. That those two go together, whereas Shikantaza goes with the practices we've developed in Soto. And the monks, as I was starting to say, I'm not sure if I completed my thought, the monks wanted to do what their ancestors had done. If I had stood up and said, you can't do this beating, it's like, well, that's what we came here for. We came here to be the men that our ancestors were. And to learn this. Now, what I will say about Fukushima was, this was a temple he had, this was a system he had inherited. On the other hand, he was one of the only, or very, very few, Japanese teachers who allowed Westerners, and particularly Western women, in the training in the training hall itself with the monks. So if you went to a heiji, first of all, there was no place for women to practice in the Soto tradition. Mm. And if you went to other temples, women weren't allowed, but he did that. He did that. So he did what he could to move a certain directionally with the system he had without being kicked out as the kancho of the Tofukuji system.
Did the women include any Japanese women?
Only one that I saw who was married to a Westerner. But I through Jeff Shore, I gave a talk a couple of times at which university it was, Hanazono in Kyoto. And when I said, and there were Japanese women in his class, it was a class on Buddhism or Zen. When I said that I was practicing in the Soto in the training hall of Tofugiji, it was like, ugh. it's like a rotten smell in the room. It's like, that's just too rough. Mm-hmm. It's just too rough, you know, for the sensibilities mm-hmm. of Japanese women. It just wouldn't fit with the culture. Mm-hmm. But he would not, I mean, there would have to be a reason why he accepted a Japanese woman. Because he said, I'm accepting this woman because she's married to an American. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's some Western mentality as a woman. It was very interesting to be in Japan because Hoitsu Roshi, the son of Suzuki Roshi, when he taught me Japanese phrases, he did not teach me the way women speak. He taught me the way men mm-hmm. speak. Mm-hmm. Because it wasn't suitable for me to do the little... Mm-hmm. Mata, job.
Probably not for you. Yeah.
What? What did you say?
Certainly not for you.
Well, but he had a whole group of women there, and he taught yeah. it would be like mata ne. It's how a woman would say it, and a man would say job mata. And that's why he. And he had daughters. He had daughters, mm-hmm. so he knew obviously knew the forms that women speak. Mm-hmm. They all do. But for the women mm-hmm. he was teaching when we mm-hmm. came to practice in Japan. They don't see us the same way. We're somewhere between a man and a woman on the scale of the Japanese gender stereotypes.
So you still teach some of the koans that you studied with him with students here. How do you do that without that setting?
I'm not doing it right now. I found that the koan practice that he taught me actually engendered more anxiety in people. And I thought it was good for Zen practice. Mm. In fact, I have to send them to therapy when they start Zen practice. When they start koan practice, it was just, it was, that's not what, you know, it just didn't work for me. Mm-hmm. But I think that, it's too anxiety provoking, the constant being wrong
being
out.
Constantly being wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Your ego takes a real beating and mm-hmm. you have to sign up for that.
Mm-hmm. Did he have an opinion of those like Sambo Kyodan guys who we inherited through the Harada Yasutani people?
You know, I think his opinion was he was very worried about that. That would have been a nice way to put it. And because he knew I practiced with this community, he didn't give me the full Monty on that. Mm-hmm. But he did other people talk about his disappointments. And particularly what he called dokufon. And I think we have somebody in AZTA who practices that, doing koans over the phone. He did not like that. Yeah, but I could really...
Dokufon.
Dokufon, yeah, doing koans over the phone.
Yeah, and James Ford and Freeport, and they've all done that.
Yeah, and Nelson Foster.
Yeah.
So right. He would... And it's very interesting because I've done dokufon. Not myself to other students, but with teachers in that tradition. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get what I got from him. Now, maybe I wouldn't have sitting in person. Maybe that, you know, monk energy that he developed from 14 was so powerful, but I felt like it was mind-to-mind transmission when I was with him. Mm-hmm. And I did not feel that during dokufon. No matter how good the connection was.
Did you have FaceTime then, or was it just
I did have Skype and FaceTime, but it didn't come through the screen and grab me. Now, would it have had I been in the room and had it been a sesshin, you know? Mm-hmm. Yes, probably there would have been more of that. But I remember going into the room sometimes with an idea, okay, this is a pretty good answer for this koan, and being wrung out without him saying anything, and walking out of the room and knowing what was wrong with my answer. Mm-hmm. Something had happened in that transaction that I couldn't tell what it was, but it happened.
Excuse me, I have to go.
Oh.
Sorry.
Can you get out all right?
Yes, I can. Sorry to interrupt.
It's okay.
I'm
just curious about, so if you're at the moment you're not teaching koans, and what aspect is do you feel like it, that you're teaching now that is still Rinzai, or do you just feel like it's you're teaching a sort of combination of approaches?
Well, generally I use Soto rituals because that's what I've been really trained in. But I was changed. And so it would come out more in Doksan when someone would say, you know, I'm having a hard time accepting myself. And I would say, become acceptance. I'd say, I don't know how to do that. I said, well, that's your job. And that's what I made of the koans. It's like you need to become acceptance itself. It's not that there's a you who's going to accept you. Become acceptance. That's Rinzai. So that was how I adapted it, because I was changed by it.
Is that in the book? That sounds really interesting.
There you have it. You could try that.
Do you are you teaching in a temple, or you do lay practice? Sorry,
it's okay. I've been recently reoriented anyway. I had a retreat center where I practiced and led sesshin and did training for priests. We've since sold it actually to a Tibetan group because it was 200 and some acres plus the two houses I had built plus the zendo. Mm. So I tried actually to give it away in the Soto tradition. I couldn't find anyone who wanted to take it. So it's now in the hands of some Tibetans, which is great. They're very good with money. I always say, the Tibetans have the money. They don't mind asking for it. And whereas it's a little shy for us, Zen people. So I don't have that anymore, but I teach a weekly Zazen Kai on Stanford campus, where I live. And I have another group through Stanford University Women's Club of Women, which is what the picture was that I sent you. And then I also teach for the Office of Religious Life, Zazen for beginners. So I have just a couple of students that I'm still working with, you know, in that way. Most of my priests have gotten Dharma transmission and they're running the centers that I had, which is what I understood was the way. But it seems like teachers don't always let go of their centers, and I have. So anyway, I have two centers that I look over the shoulder of my Dharmaras when they ask me to. And then I have my groups that I teach in Palo Alto. And I have a couple students who've been ordained as priest or this or that or about to be ordained that I will complete with in some way.
How did your husband's practice evolve?
Well, he did do the koan practice. Yeah, he did. And now, at this particular time, he's just finished an MFA in poetry. That's where it went. And so he's working on publishing a book.
I have a question. You've been doing this for a long time. Do you feel that the kinds of issues, problems, questions that people bring to their practice have changed?
Yes, but I'll say more. I think, you know, when I first started practicing, which was in the 60s, with Suzuki Roshi, people wanted to get high. And they were young people, and they'd throw themselves into communal living, and some miraculous thing was going to happen to their minds. In fact, I'm writing something about the stages that we go through called the Eight Winds. You know the Eight Winds in Buddhism? Pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, and fame and gain, something like that, fame and shame. So those are kind of the stages we go through. So, you know, the early stages, early life stages that we went through were about this wonderful opening of the mind and this whole new way of life as things were idealized in the 60s. But as we get older, we realize, you know, the mortality thing. As we start to lose our own friends and we're still here and we say, oh, I see, this is how it works. And what have I done with this life? So I think those questions are more important as we age. And the young people that are going into the practice now do not necessarily want to have a monastic life. They want to bring Buddhist values to social action, and as it should be.
People still looking to get a Kensho experience, like a fabulous white light, changing, get rid of all my problems experience?
Yes, I think so. And you can usually spot them pretty quickly when they come into your practice place. It's like they're spouting the ideas and ideals of that. Push hard and I'll get an enlightenment experience. I try to...
That was certainly, you know, my experience starting with in Rinzai with Edo Roshi. It was that push hard and have the big magical experience. And there seems to be something of that built into the advertising for Rinzai.
I think so. And because I think in Rinzai, I mean, Soto Suzuki Roshi used to say, you know, practice is like rain. You know, you don't really realize when you got wet. You know, you're standing in the rain, and at some point you're soaked. So that was his way of talking about
it. Is more go out there and wait to be struck by lightning.
You're going to be struck by lightning, and that's essential, and that's the beginning of your practice. This was Fukushima's thing. Mm-hmm. You need to have that breakthrough. Mm-hmm. It's essential for your practice to have that breakthrough. But it's not the end point, which is one of the things that was sold to us in the beginning. Mm-hmm. Shibayama Roshi said, I think something like this about enlightenment. Enlightenment is like when you're on a plane and it lands. Okay, it didn't crash, it lands. So when you get off the plane, then your work begins. You make the journey. And so this essential, you've got to land first. And then practice unfolds from there.
Yeah, I think in having been in another tradition for a long time, it certainly seems to be true to me that many people I know had these incredible experiences. And we thought, that was it. We didn't realize, I think, sometime for years that's really just the beginning.
Yes.
You know?
Well, and also, what is the difference between that experience and some kind of drug experience? How have you refined yourself so that you can make use of this appropriately with other people? And so just having the experience, we also used to think that just having the experience made someone reliable.
Right.
We've now learned that's off the table.
That's
off the table.
All right, I think we have to stop here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.